Hi, and welcome back. I'm Patrick Polk, and you're listening to The Rules of Investing. This week, I'll be talking with one of the legends of the Australian investing industry, Anton Tagliaferro. Anton has been far too accomplished in his career to sum up his achievement in a few seconds, but some of the highlights include launching and managing Perpetual's highly successful industrial share fund, and of course, founding Investors Mutual itself in 1998. In this episode, we discuss his current views on Australian banks and retailers, how he first developed IML's investment philosophy, and why he doesn't like the value versus growth argument. As always, if you're loving The Rules of Investing, then why not tell someone about it? Pick your favourite episode and send it to a friend, or just head on over to Apple Podcasts and hit subscribe. Either way, you're helping to increase the profile of the podcast and therefore the quality of the guests that I can bring to you. Well, that's it for now. I hope you enjoy the show. Anton, welcome to the show. It's great to have you on.
Thanks for having me here.
I'm actually, to be honest, pretty excited to be talking with you today. Having done nearly 50 episodes of this show now, there's not a lot of Australian equity managers who I haven't had a chance to speak to, who are experienced like yourself. It's a pretty short list now, so I'm really glad to have you on. I'm really excited to hear what you have to say. But before we get started, I just wanted to ask you, I know you purchased a football team a few years ago, Baltzan FC. So how's the footy team going? Are they having a good season this year?
Well, I haven't purchased them actually, but I'm a sponsor of the club, and it's a club I used to play for when I was a kid and lived back in Walter. So yeah, the season's just started, and they've started with a win and a loss. So yeah, as I said, the season's just kicked off and we'll see how it goes.
Good to hear. Well, I hope it goes well.
Thank you.
Well, let's start by talking a little bit about your investment philosophy. Investors Mutual obviously has been around for quite a while now, but I'm curious how you first developed the philosophy. You know, who or what were the major influences behind that?
Yeah, look, I guess my background was I was an accountant, and in the 1980s, I started looking at investment markets when I came to Australia, and clearly there was a lot going on in the 1980s with, big bull market, the entrepreneurs of the time, you know, Alan Bond, Robert Holmes of Court, were in the newspapers daily. There was a lot of excitement in Australia. We had the floating of the currency at the same time, deregulation of financial markets, so there was a lot going on. And really, I started to look at the stock market then as a 20-something-year-old, accountant. And obviously, I was very interested in it. It was a lot more interesting than accounting and auditing, which is what I was doing. And eventually, I got into the funds management industry when I joined Perpetual Trustees, as it was then, back in 1987, 1988. So, look, I suppose, like many others out there, I was introduced in the stock market, as something that was sort of there and exciting. Lived through the 1987 crash to see, what sort of, obviously, the contrasting bull and bear markets, I suppose, particularly the 87 crash. Anyone who was there when, market falls 25% in a day is not something you forget in a hurry. And some stocks actually fell 40 or 50% in a day. So it was pretty dramatic. As I said, fortunately, I joined Perpetual. And in the year ended June 1988, the Perpetual Industrial Share Fund, which I was managing, which I'd just started managing, ended up having a positive return. And you look at that and you see the whole turmoil in markets. And I was very influenced by that, because I think the Perpetual philosophy, and it wasn't written at the time, because at the time Perpetual looked after deceased estates, and it wasn't a fund that was available to the public. But I think it became clear, very clear to me to that period, that, Investing in the stock market is not about speculating. It's not about jumping on the latest hot stocks or hot sectors. You know, it's all about finding good, solid companies that have a long track record, that are run by honest people, that have a plan to grow their earnings, you know, and that's really what the stock market's about. So in terms of my philosophy, personal philosophy, it was really shaped by the events of the, 1985, 86, 87, 88, having lived firsthand through it as a young, as I said, I was a novice to the stock market and a young accountant, and getting to then to a place like Perpetual, which had been going for, many, many years, and looking at some of these old wills and estates that had equity portfolios that, despite the crash, held their value very well and were still well ahead of the cost of the purchase of those shares, So that was really the fundamental. From there, I moved then to other places like County NatWest and BNP. Until then, I started Investors Mutual in 1998, sorry, I'm losing track. Happens when you get old. So really, as I said, so that's what we... That's what shaped my philosophy. I'm an accountant. I discovered the stock market. I kind of went through a very dramatic period in the 80s. And I worked out pretty early, I guess, in my career that the best rewards from the stock market are for patient investors who pick good stocks and stick to them over time.
You mentioned that you've never forgotten the events of the 1987 crash. Mm-hmm. I'd love to hear a little bit about that. Could you tell us what you were doing that day, and what were you thinking when you woke up in the morning? Because you would have been in Australia, so it would have already happened in the US. I'm guessing you would have been aware of the events that were happening in the US at the time. So, mm-hmm. What were you thinking that morning, and how did you respond to that situation?
Well, look, it was quite interesting because it was actually, in the US it was Black Monday, in Australia it was Black Tuesday. But what happened is the US market had fallen. You've got to remember in those days the Dow Jones was 2,500, so, a lot lower than today. But the Dow had fallen something like 100 points on the Friday, which was quite a big drop, 4%. And I'll never forget, on the Monday, when the Australian market opened, and it was around the 2,300 level or something, 2,200 level, the market fell 86 points on the Monday, which was the largest one-day fall for a long time in Australia. So the funny thing was the headlines the next day were talking about the big drop the day before. And, of course, overnight the Dow had fallen 25%. So all these people from the day before saying, it was a correction we needed to have and we'll go on and up from here or whatever. And, of course, you're reading that stuff in the morning knowing that the Dow had fallen 25%. So, look, it was pretty amazing. I was working at Prudential at the time, Prudential Assurance, and I'll never forget, we had a whiteboard and people put up their estimate of how many points the local market would drop, and some said 200 points and some said, the worst was sort of 250 points. And when it opened down 500 points, which was 25% or more, it was a cataclysmic day. But again, a very interesting time because obviously at the time what had been performing really well was, the entrepreneurs were all the rage at the time, Christopher Skase, Holmes Accord Bond. Gold shares were extremely strong, there were people like Joe Gutnick and whatever, all their stocks were sort of doubling and trebling every month or two or whatever. So look, again, it taught me a very important lesson that on the day of a crash such as that, and I think we saw a bit of that in 2007, 2008, the GFC, everything falls. In a crash, everything falls. I call it the good, the bad, and the ugly. Everything falls. But then what does happen, when sanity prevails and the panic subsides, which it does eventually, you don't get, markets can't fall 25% a day, because if that happened in a week, you'd be down to zero almost, So I guess, you have to rationalize that it will subside. And what does happen after those sort of huge corrections is people, they do go back to the stock market, but it is the good stocks that do recover. The I don't know what to say. That a lot of the crap, all the froth and bubble, which in the boom was, you know, what, you know, very in the headlines all the time and chased by many investors, a lot of that stuff just goes to nothing, really, you know. It just gets forgotten and swept away. But the good stocks, you know, the Brambles, the Amcors, the whatever, the Borrells, you know, they're still around 30-odd years later and still there. So I think that was another important lesson, is to understand that blue sky is great when it's going and very exciting, but, you know, that can often end very quickly. And it's always, you know, it's the sort of solid, steady stocks which have got good fundamental basis that will eventually recover.
With these growth stocks that have been so popular in recent years, not just in Australia, but we'll keep the discussion to Australia for now, there's been a number of years now that these stocks have been running really, really hard. And, you know, people who don't invest in these stocks have, a lot of their performance has suffered as a result. So I guess I'm kind of curious, have you ever been tempted to change your philosophy and buy these growth stocks? Has the old mantra of this time is different ever been tempting to you?
Look, it's not as if we don't want to buy stocks that we believe, you know, we want to buy stocks whose earnings are going to grow. That's what investing is all about, you know, because at the end of the day, share prices don't go up because they have to. You know, share prices will eventually go up in a sustainable manner because a company's profits will grow. So there's no, you know, we're not anti-growth. The question is, what do you pay for that growth, you know, and how optimistic are the forecasts of the growth? So again, you know, we own companies like Sonic Healthcare and CSL and Brambles, and some people might say, oh, they're growth stocks. Well, like, again, I don't like having this line in the sand of growth versus value. You know, there's no such thing. What we're trying to do is buy, you know, what we see as good quality stocks, where we think the prospects are that their earnings and dividends will increase over the long term, which, as I said, ultimately should lead to a higher share price. So it's not as if we got anything against, again, I don't want to be, you know, Afterpay or WiseTech or A2 Milk or whatever. The question is, how optimistically priced are those companies priced, you know? Is all the good news in the price, and how would those companies react in a different stock market, where perhaps investors are not just pricing in blue sky, but pricing in, you know, actual earnings and dividends of today and next year, not of what might happen in 5 or 10 or 20 years' time, which tends to happen, you know, in bull markets or when people are excited about growth. That's what happens, is blue sky gets more than factored into share prices, you know. But then, you know, that doesn't last forever. You get a new period of time, which is more, you know, rational, perhaps a bit more cautious, which generally happens after a correction. And, you know, those companies can get very harshly done by.
What actually defines a quality or a good company to you? What are the essential characteristics that you want to see in a company before you would consider putting it in your portfolio?
Well, look, we've always said, I think, since our inception that what we look for is companies. We like to see companies with a good competitive advantage. In other words, they're generally number one or two in their industry. That gives them scale, you know, scale in terms of research and development, scale in terms of IT, et cetera, you know, so that's important. We like companies with capable management, you know, and we often spend a lot of time meeting with management and you know, we're talking about honest people with the integrity, with the right motivations, you know. They're not in it just to make money for themselves, but to try and make money for all shareholders, which is important. You know, and companies with capable management, as I said. Recurring earnings is important to us. So, you know, we like to, while a lot of people, you know, run in and out of, I don't know, iron ore stocks as the iron ore price moves up and down, we'd rather buy companies which are a bit more predictable, you know, have more predictable earnings. So, your Amcor with its packaging and basically providing packaging to the food and household sectors is a pretty recurring, predictable sort of earning stream. You know, those sort of Woolworths with their supermarkets, etc. That's what we like to see, rather than highly cyclical earnings. And of course, those sort of companies, hopefully, that can grow over time. So that's what we're looking for. You know, is competitive advantage, run by capable management, recurring predictable earnings, and hopefully companies that can grow over time. We want to own a collection of those sort of companies. They won't all perform well at the same time, you know, and we want to buy them at a reasonable price, and that's important as well. So it's not just saying, oh, yes, A2 Milk is going to do well or Wystech's going to do well, but then you have to look at the price, because if Wystech's on a P of 250, well, you'd say that's probably a little bit high, you know, that's probably taking into account quite a bit of blue sky. So I guess it's a balance between looking at the quality of the company, the growth, and what you're paying for the growth. You know, are you paying a reasonable price?
Let's talk a little bit more specifics. We've just had some retail sales figures come in yesterday that have shown, off the top of my head, I think it was the 9th straight month of contraction in retail sales in Australia. And in the lead up to reporting season in August, the retailers were doing it pretty tough. But certainly to my surprise, and I think to the surprise of many others, retailers ended up having a pretty good reporting season, with several of the big ones actually producing really good results and rallying off those results. So I'm curious, are you actually seeing any value in this sector currently?
Look, I think many of them rallied on downgraded expectations, to be honest, and I think the results weren't necessarily, you know, very good. They were just better than I think people hoped for. And obviously, you know, two cuts in interest rates, recent cuts in interest rates, a stimulatory budget obviously makes the outlook a bit brighter than probably 6 months ago. Having said that, look, we're very cautious on the retail sector. You know, it's the discretionary retail sector. We do own things like Coles and Woolworths. In fact, Coles, we bought a lot of them on the recent demerger because we thought at around the, you know, under $13, it looked reasonable value. I think it got down to 12, whatever. You know, we bought a lot of Coles. We own Woolworths as well. You know, so they're our core retail stocks in the portfolio. Again, as I said, strong competitive advantage, recurring predictable earnings, capable management, you know, growing, all those things. The price, maybe they're getting a little bit expensive now, but certainly they're very good companies. And we also own in some of our portfolios some Myer shares, which has been a disappointing one, although the result today was, you know, a bit better than expected as well. So fortunately, the stock is you know, rising back to reasonable levels. So look, but yeah, and we have owned things like Harvey Norman from time to time. But, you know, those stocks, the Harvey Normans, the JV Hi-Fis, the all the, you know, Reject Shop, they tend to be very cyclical. They tend to move around, you know, depending on economic conditions, consumer sentiment, etc. So we tend to be fairly cautious generally of that sector. And you know, as I said, the core sort of food retailing, Coles and Woolworths, tend to fit our philosophy a lot better than some of the others.
I'd be curious to hear a little bit about your view on Myer. Could you tell us a bit about what you like about the stock there?
Yeah, look, as I said, we probably bought too early, but the stock is recovering back to levels, you know, not far from hopefully levels where we bought. The good thing about the Australian market as compared, for example, the UK department store markets in disarray, the good thing about Australia is there's only two supermarket chains. You know, there's Myer and David Jones. If you look at the UK, there's Marks and Spencers and Selfridges and C&A and House of Fraser. You know, there's a lot more competition. In Australia, there's only two. It is a tough sector, of course, as people shop more online, etc. But I think the thing about Myer is they have good management in place now, and what they're doing is they're reducing their floor space as much as they can, you know, doing deals with the landlords. They're focusing on areas where they make money. So obviously, you know, the thing about department stores, they've been caught really because they have too much space in areas such as, you know, because I guess 10 or 15 years ago, they used to sell a lot of TVs or bedding or furniture or whatever. Well, that's all declined, A, because they're specialty stores, and B, because of online shopping. So they've ended up with too much space for the amount of sales that they do. So they have to rationalize their space. They do make money on certain lines, obviously things like makeup, clothing, perfumery, those sort of things are very profitable. So what they have to do is resize to where their market is, which means, you know, they will have to cut sales back but focus on the more profitable sales, and obviously build an online presence. And again, you know, Maya has been very slow at doing it, but we see quite a bit of potential because they do have, you know, millions of Maya card holders. And they don't really communicate much with them. They don't know much about their millions of, you know, Maya customers, which is you know, ludicrous, really. So again, if you could imagine Maya as a slimmed down department store, you know, only selling the profitable lines rather than all this space that they can't, which they're paying rent on, and they're not getting many sales from. And on top of that, you know, an online capability linked to their millions of Maya One customers, you know, that's where Maya is ultimately going to head to. And if you think about that, that's probably, you know, worth a lot more than where the share price is today. Of course, there's a lot of work to do to get there, but that's the potential we see in Maya.
Well, you mentioned interest rate cuts there, and I know that you wrote a letter, an open letter to the RBA back in, I think it was 2016, about interest rates and implored them not to cut rates further. Australia looks like we're going to be joining the zero interest rate party soon, or at least getting pretty close to it. So how do you think our banking system might hold up in an environment of either zero or near zero rates, and potentially even with quantitative easing happening here as well? Do you think the banks do okay in that environment, or what are the risks there?
Yeah, look, I think to go back to the background of that letter of 2016, the reason why we wrote that letter was because, you know, housing was booming at the time, house prices were booming. And we thought, you know, a further rate in interest rate cuts in 2016 would only have, you know, made the boom even more ridiculous in terms of pricing, and, you know, auction clearance rates were very high, etc. So that's, you know, interest rates are a very blunt tool, because while, you know, the theory is you cut rates and it stimulates economic activity, often it can also stimulate it in the wrong places, you know, and in the case, as I said, 2016, we already had house prices going through at ridiculous, growing at ridiculous percentages, and a cut then wouldn't have been appropriate. Today, you know, they've cut rates twice, so we think it is more appropriate because, you know, the housing market has gone in reverse. There's a bit of stress out there with the consumer, so we think it makes sense to have cut rates. So, look, lower interest rates, again, they're good for the banks from the point of view that they support any potential borrowers they have who may be under stress. So, you know, I was reading just yesterday that the amount of arrears in places like WA and Queensland on mortgages are sort of 2%, which is quite high. Obviously, interest rate cuts means those people, the affordability of mortgages is more affordable. So that's good from the bank's point of view, that there's less stress in their customers and they can, you know, repay their loans back over time. The bad news from the bank's point of view, of course, is if you look at CBA, they've got something like 150, you know, over 100 billion in deposits in current accounts where they pay no interest on that money, and they make a good, you know, when home loan rates are 6 or 7 or 8%, that's a nice bit of free money, if you like, to have on deposit to use. But obviously, as the rate charged to odd loans declines, you know, the benefit of that free float declines. So, you know, lower rates, as I said, for banks, it's a two-edged sword. On the one hand, it supports any borrowers who may have problems, you know, so delinquencies will stay low. On the other hand, it does impact on their margins.
So considering all of that, do you think that the banks look attractive at the moment, or do you think that the price has already factored these things in?
Look, we're a bit cautious on the banks, as I said, because lower interest rates will mean lower margins. And on top of that, there is, you know, with the housing slowdown, there is more competition for, you know, a slower amount of credit that's being applied for. So that's not, you know, it's not good for margins. So look, we're a bit cautious. On the other hand, the banks have still got quite a bit to do on the cost side. in terms of, you know, they can probably save quite a bit to getting a bit more efficient. But on the other hand, you know, longer term, you do have new entrants coming into the market. You know, obviously people like Google Pay and et cetera. So, you know, we're cautious. You know, we're mixed on the banks.
Well, a lot of the attention of investors at the moment is focused on things like trade wars and monetary policy, both of which I think are pretty well understood at this point. And probably more to the point, they're issues over which the average investor really has no control or any insight as to what the outcomes might be. So I'm kind of curious, you know, what are some of the risks in the markets today that you see where investors actually do have some control and can actually take some action?
Look, it's a confusing time, I think, for investors. You know, you have, as we were saying earlier, you got interest rates at record lows. So it means your alternative to, if you don't put money in the stock market, your term deposits are not earning much money. Bonds are at record lows. So again, you can't really buy bonds to enhance your return. So, you know, the stock market is benefiting from that lack of choice, you know, and what we're seeing, obviously, is stock markets around the world are being supported by lower interest rates. But again, one's got to be cautious, you know, because as I said, I think even earlier, you know, we are 10 years in the US, we're 10 years into an economic recovery in the US. Australia's now 27 years or whatever of positive economic growth. So, you know, there will be a slowdown at some stage. So, and bond markets are pointing to that, right? And at the same time, it is a very competitive environment. If you look across most industries, you know, retail, banking, telecommunications, it is very competitive. So it is, you know, one's got to be extra cautious at the moment. And what you're seeing in the market is you're seeing, you know, stocks where the prospects look good trade at very high PEs, you know, so you've mentioned the WiseTech and the CSLs and the, you know, those sort of stocks are trading at extremely high PEs because, okay, they will grow for the next 2 to 3 years, but potentially some of those are getting very overvalued, you know. And then you have other stocks, the bottom of the range, where the prospects are not as bright, such as Meijer, such as Pact Group, such as Amcor, such as Caltex, you know, but they're still viable companies in the main part, still making money, etc., which are trading at very low PEs, you know, because the growth at the moment, they're struggling, they're in competitive areas. So, you know, that's the challenge for investors is most of the attractive stocks on the market, which are obviously attractive, are trading at very high multiples. So, you know, that's the challenge. So, and the risks, you know, as I said, there are plenty of risks in terms of economic risks, the trade wars, etc. So, look, it is a time for caution. I don't think we're at the start of a major bull market or whatever, but it is definitely a time for caution. Whereas I said, on the one hand, you know, equity markets will continue to be supported by lower interest rates. But on the other hand, you know, many sectors and many companies are finding it very difficult to sustain or grow their earnings.
Well, that actually concludes the main part of the interview, but I do have some favourite questions that I like to go through with every one of my guests. So if you've got, I think we've got enough time. It usually takes about 10 or 15 minutes. We'll jump into those three questions now. First of all, could you share with us something that you've read recently? It could be a book, an article, a piece of research, or even something that you've watched or listened to online that really impressed you or really blew you away?
Nothing that springs to mind, to be honest. I read so many articles every day. Some of them are great, some of them whatever, some of them I put in a pile to keep and read. So, I, again, nothing springs to mind. But I do like reading a lot of the value fund managers stuff that comes out of the US, you know, to understand what's happening there. But as I said, I read so many of articles. Not all are very good, but nothing springs to mind at the moment.
No worries.
Maybe ask me that question some other time. Yeah.
That's okay.
I'll go and have a look at the collection on my desk. But yeah.
No worries. If you could go back in time to when you were finishing school or university, and give yourself just one piece of investing advice, what would it be?
Well, it's to, if you're going to always have a diversified aim to have one day as you get hopefully wealthier as you study and graduate, a diversified portfolio of good quality assets. You know, that's what pays off over the long term. From the stock market point of view, try and get in a bit early, average yourself in. Don't get caught up in the hype. And unfortunately, as I said, a lot of people, when they first get involved in the stock market, they go for the hype. The hype sectors are the ones where seemingly there's, rivers of gold and lots of money to be made. So whether it's pre-87 with the entrepreneurs and gold stocks, whether it was 2001 or whatever, 2000 with the tech stocks, et cetera, et cetera. So try and differentiate between the hype, what's real and what's hyped up, and stay away from the hyped up sectors and try and buy, good solid companies that will be around for a long time.
Now, I am conscious of what you said before about not wanting to call out a individual stock, but this is a question that I like to ask all my guests. So I hope you'll forgive me for this. Before I do ask the question though, I always do like to insert a little bit of a disclaimer. Don't try this at home. I'm not actually saying to anybody listening that you should go out there and put all of your money in a single stock and forget about it. This is supposed to be a exercise in long-term thinking and a little bit of fun. So with that being said, if the markets were going to close for the next 5 years, starting from tomorrow, and you could only own shares in a single company, what would it be?
Well, it's only fun if it goes up, right? So it's not much fun if it goes the other way. But look, I think if I had to choose one of the top 50 companies, probably Amcor's, I think, a reasonably safe company. It's a global company. It does packaging for mainly food, household, pharmaceuticals. Pays a nice yield. It's very well managed. It's just taken over Bemis in the US, where they're looking to derive, extract $180 million of synergies, which adds about 10 or 15% to Amcor's earnings, over the next 3 years. So I think that's a good, solid company, which one can buy, hopefully, without too many shocks in the next 3 years. That's one definitely. At the smaller end, if I had to pick one, again, I'm reluctant to pick one stock, but we really like Mayn Pharma, which has been absolutely beaten up. Mayn Pharma is the old FH Faulding, which has been around for many, many years. They are big in generics in the US, generic drugs in the US, which is going through a pretty hard time at the moment because wholesalers are being very harsh on generic suppliers. But having said that, Mayn Pharma also has two other divisions. They have a branded drug division, which is doing quite well and growing very well. And they also have a contract manufacturing. They built a $100 million plant in the US, and they basically manufacture drugs for themselves and for other companies. And that's also performing well. So, look, the shares have absolutely been beaten up. Pharmaceutical consumption is not going to decline. They're in the right sector. And that one, look, again, risk return at the current levels, I would have to say, is quite, it's got a good balance sheet. The chairman is Roger Corbett, who ran Woolworths successfully for many years and who's a ex-Reserve Bank member, very conservative guy. So, look, that one on the smaller end, I think, maybe a bit more speculative, people might say, but actually it is backed by some very solid businesses, solid people, and in a good sector.
Well, Anton, that's all my questions for today. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak with you. Thanks for coming on the show and sharing your time and your thoughts with us.
Pleasure. Thanks for asking me, and good luck to everybody out there. Tough markets, even for people like me who've been around for a long time. It's always difficult navigating true markets, particularly now with rates so low, valuations stretched, all this volatility and noise because of the trade war and Brexit. So good luck to everybody out there.